My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest is the UK's leading natural lifestyle coach. After spending 3 years in the British Army, he undertook an 18-year journey which explores ways to grow physically, socially, and spiritually. In this episode, we talk movement, sleep, nature, and the power of the breath. Ancestral health is modern-day wealth. Episode 19, Tony Riddle. This is Declassified. Did you join the army?
I think end of 92.
I think I got out like 96.
95. 3.5 years later, so 3.5 years.
Did you go anywhere, Bosnia?
No, I trained to go to Bosnia, but our sister regiment went instead.
So what was you in?
Raw logistics. As a B2 radio operator. Driver of radio operator.
Where was you based?
After Purbrook, of course, went to into, what was it called? Blacktown Barracks, wasn't it? I can't remember now. Yeah, it's too close to home, though, man.
Where are you from?
From Langley, so Berkshire, so just outside, you know, Slough, Windsor, that kind of area.
Is that where you was born, Langley?
No, born in Reading, and then my parents moved out to Newbury. And then they moved into Langley, I think when I was one, but it was my dad had the brainwave of setting up a business and then spent the rest of his time regretting it, I think, you know.
What did he do?
Engineering. So at the beginning it was kind of yeah, and then engineering went,
you know, really?
Down the pan.
What year was that then?
Oh,
the 70s or 80s?
No, so it was there was two dips, wasn't there? So I think around about the time when I left the army, he went under. Yeah, the business went under around about then. So about 95, I guess it went under. So I think from I'd say mid 80s to that point, ego was just keeping him in there.
Oh, really?
And he should have let it go years ago. You know?
You can hammer so many people.
Well, it becomes their personality, you know. Yeah. It's a bit like military in a way. You know, you become, it's part of your badge, isn't it? So people say, you know, you're identified as this rather than I'm a Tony.
Yeah, yeah.
I do what Tony does, you know. Yeah. It's a label that they walk around with, you see.
Did you see him much as a in childhood then?
Did I see him much as a childhood? We used to see him, I'd say we, it's my sister and I, mainly on Sundays, you know, and the rest of the time it's really late nights. And then he'd be knackered from the whole day and the evening, so he wouldn't get up till late, so we were already out the house. And it changed because as money got tight, my mum went out to work, and she went out to work. She like became a cleaner and a caretaker at the school, then became run a bakery, and she was doing like really early shifts, which meant that the responsibility was kind of handed over to my dad to get us out the house and get us to school. So we used to see him a little bit more in the morning then.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the best start to the day, you know what I mean? It was like a digestive biscuit and a cup of tea and off we go, you know?
Did you get out, like, because obviously you're out in the wilds now, as they say.
Yeah.
Childhood, what was that like?
What was my childhood like? Well, we lived in a village. I kind of roll it out like a concrete village, really. My parents' probably favourite activity, if anything, is probably watching TV and in front of the box, right? So outside activity was very limited until I kind of joined a gang of kids, I'd say, and we found this place that was known, passed down generation to generation. It was called the Gravel Pits, and everyone used to go there. But to get to it, you have to kind of get butt with your nails and fingertips across a train bridge with the intercities like blasting underneath, bam, bam, and we used to get over into the gravel pits, the forbidden realm, barefoot climbing trees and just having a whale of a time. And that was punctuated, I'd say, in amongst a concrete existence, going from one box to another box, which is...
But that was for fun. There was nothing...
That was amazing to be able to go and do that. Yeah, I mean, absolutely amazing. I think that's probably... It's at the acorn of where I am today, because probably at my... When I felt my best, it was in those moments. If I look at childhood holidays, it could have been wherever we went in the globe, but it was really camping, you know? Going out in
on
nature.
On the beach.
Nature. And it's being in nature, you suddenly realise that those profound states of happiness and well-being, you can really link it to that. And then... Through that, we went into a school, let's say, and in the school environment for me, the one that I went to is now closed down. So it was a very violent school. Do you remember the In-Betweeners?
Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Davies. Yeah, his name was Greg Davies. The big guy. He was actually my English teacher, right?
Oh, so
in my school, he was my English teacher. And I'll give you an idea of what the school must be like, because he used to sit with headphones on. We used to have headphones then, right, you know, and Walkmans. With his Walkman, with his feet up on the desk, right? And we'd be in the class, and people were going under desks with compasses, jabbing each other in the legs. It's just terrible school, you know. So I come away from that with very little, you know, as an experience, other than, you know, you're either a bully or you're being bullied in that experience. So it was one of those camps that if you were smart, then you didn't get bullied.
Did you do stuff extra curricular, like martial arts or anything, like football or rugby?
I was in the...
Was you part of any kind of team there?
I was good at specialist sports. So up until a certain age, I mean, I excelled at running. I was, you know, super fast as a kid. But then it wasn't cool to be that in the school I went to. It was more cool to smoke weed and just, you know, that kind of environment, really. Mm. And then joyriding cars and stuff like that. It was just the wrong environment for a kid to be cultured into.
Where is that geographically?
In Langley, so in Berkshire, just outside Slough.
Oh, yeah.
And as I say, it just got closed down in the end. It just wasn't a great environment really to stimulate growth, I guess, you know. But we used to have an air cadet station on the school, 2424 squadron, and so I joined that along with a cousin of mine and a few mates that we were hanging out. So we could already see, I guess, that was a way of escaping it, but also we could go into nature, so we'd be taking out an exercise and yeah, it's very, very different. So you could feel the nurturing of that experience. And also, I guess, also the feeling of male rites of passage again and elders and stuff like that, because it's in there, it's in the military, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I then gravitated towards thinking post-school that I know what I need to do. I need to join the RAF. And I had another cousin that was in the RAF, and his experience, I was like, yeah, I think I should do this. And so post-school, I then went into electronic engineering because I thought I'd need that for the RAF. I wanted to go down a...
Was you bright as a kid?
I'm bright. I'm bright now and switched on. Just wasn't in terms of sitting down and learning facts in an environment where the teachers have their feet up on desks with headphones on and kids jabbing your leg with compasses and me looking out the window thinking I'd rather be outside. It just wasn't the environment for me to learn in. Do you know what I mean?
Mate, I
have resentment for it.
I went to an all boys school. It was like a naval school in Hull, and detested it. Bullying. You know what I mean? Using bullying or being bullied. Exactly. So when you're speaking to me now, it really resonates. I detested the whole thing of schooling. So we put our kids are young. They're in a Steiner school now.
Oh, brilliant.
And I walk there and I'm like, drop them off. So emotional to see them setting fires, climbing trees.
Yeah.
So good. Anyway, that's for another...
Yeah, but that's what you'd want to tap into, right? Yeah. And that's kind of from experience. So we have the same. We unschool our kids. They don't go to school now. So you know, it's child-led learning. Then they have an experience of, tell me about this iPhone, and you've got like what could be a matter of minutes to tell them about an iPhone, but they've absorbed everything they need to in that moment. So the more I understand the educational system now and how it works is that we have this absorbent mind, and if the absorbent mind is stimulated, then of course you're going to go away with a whopping education. But if you put 30 kids in a class and only three of them are having absorbent moments, the rest aren't. They're kind of listening to stuff that they actually have no interest in, or they grow negative connotations towards it, inadequacies, let's say, because they don't quite understand subjects. But others might be going, yeah, this is amazing, I'm getting it. And then the others are going, ah. And then in another class, it might be different. The others who are experiencing inadequacy might have absorbent moments. And then we get specialist subjects. But if it was child-led learning, it would be like, you know, everyone would have this thing where they go, oh, I'm really interested in that. Okay, let's nurture that. I'm really interested in that. Let's nurture that. And I think for me now, understanding what to be bright is basically someone being around to create the perfect environment for you, to enable you to have those absorbent moments and to nurture them.
And nurture them, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's it.
And encourage, it's really good. And what was your, I suppose...
I came out of that. I went into college to study electronic engineering, and then I just found it felt the same as the schooling system for me in a way. It's in the same village, in the same, going into the same concrete block, and so I tried to get in the RAF. I just went one day, didn't tell my parents, just rocked up on the day, sat a test and they just said, we don't think you're ready right now. I think you should come back in a year's time. And I was like, oh man, I remember how gutted I felt, you know. But next door was the army recruitment center. So I was with one of my mates and I said, I think I'm just going to go, fuck it, I'm just going to go and do it. So yeah, I walked in and at the time they were heavily influencing the raw logistics corps at that moment. It's you've got to sign up. So that's what I did. And then it was a matter of months, I think, from that moment, yeah.
Was it? 92,
you
joined? 92,
yeah.
So were you excited about joining?
I think it was, it's a mixed emotion, really. I remember my dad, I think part of it was I know my dad wanted to be in the military. His dad was, in the war and was in the, he was a signaller and he got in the motorcycle display team, helmets, he's like in display teams and stuff like that, amazing guy. And then my other granddad, he was in the military police, right? So it was kind of, I think for them, it was like, if I had the chance, I would have done it, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think part of it was this wanting to make my dad proud, you know what I mean? And the other side of it was there was so much drugs and crime going about where we were kids that for me, it was a form of escapism, you know? It's a form of getting away and just, yeah, and finding something. And knowing, of course, from my experiences from the air cadets that I could make that reconnection, be in nature, get physically fit and do all those things that I'd love doing outside that classroom environment that wasn't nurturing me.
How old was you?
So 17 and a half, I think, that stage, yeah.
Did you enjoy it then? Because you're 3.5 years in.
Did I enjoy it? I loved it. The beginning of it was amazing. I loved all the physical activity and I loved all that. You know, again, it was, yeah. And I was rolled out as almost like a poster boy because I was so good at my kit and my boots and stuff like that. And it was whenever new recruits come in, it was me that was doing the demos and how to do their kit. I was great. I was a driver, radio operator, so I was great at driving. So then I become an OC's driver within it. You know, there was perks of it. You know, it was amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
But I had a car accident and I remember putting all my money and everything I had into buying a car. And this was between Purbright and going to Abingdon, so you were kind of in a holding unit, right? While they assign you wherever your posting would be. And I'd saved up for this car. Anyway, it was one of the days, and there was nothing to do in the day in this place. It was like, I think that's where it started to go wrong for me. We were in there for like a year and waiting for a posting. Oh. And so again, you got start to see there was bullying behavior. It was kind of the same information rolling out. And you could understand it. People were suffering. They're in the same unit. They don't know where they're going. They don't know what they're doing. They're pulled away from their families. It was like a weird position to be in, right? So I think one of the days we decided, oh, come on, let's go into the town. And we knew, of course, we weren't meant to be going into the town. But we gave the nod to the guards who were on their post, and we just went in my new car into the town, and I had a really nasty car accident. And I flipped the car, slid on the roof for like 120 foot, nearly took a woman out of the pram, put my hand up through the sunroof, went through my hand, just nasty. And but there wasn't like, I remember going to hospital, and then post hospital I was straight in the jail, man. I was like, you know, so it was like a weird, it kind of blew it for me in that moment.
Yeah.
There wasn't
your fault, the car accident?
No, well, in my mind, no. It's like I overtook a Task Force van and then he decided to turn right as I'm past him already. So the nose of his vehicle hit the back of my car.
Yeah.
As he's, you know, jumped back in the side. They have a side door, sliding door.
Yeah, yeah.
So he jumped in. I don't believe he looked. And I think he just put the foot on the gas and just went right. But because I nearly hit a woman in a pram, of course, who was around to see it, it just looks like I'm the aggressor and we're a bunch of kids driving up a hill, you know, but it wasn't the case. So it didn't bode well for me. So my money and everything I'd put into the car had gone. The car had gone. And it's bound to be, it's a nasty one. It was kind of traumatizing, I'd say. But there was no comfort post that. It was just straight into, right, here you go. And so that's your beret gone, your belt gone, your shoelaces gone.
Where'd you go, Colchester?
No, just on the camp. In the camp. But it was, again, it's just a weird, for me, it was a very strange way of dealing with it. And I think post that, it was never the same, you know?
Yeah, your love for it just
wasn't. It kind of was like, this isn't great for me.
Yeah.
And I remember being depressed after that. I remember feeling just not that. I just didn't feel great, you know.
Yeah. Low, a bit like
really low. I remember being feeling like suicidal in the army, and you know, I think disconnected from family, your tribe, your friends, and then having that experience, and so then not feeling like I'm connected to any of it. So there were moments that I had my mates in there, but again, I just felt like I'd fallen out of what could be. I mean, it's nasty to say. I don't believe that we should be saying like brainwashing, but it felt like I'd managed to step away from it,
yeah,
and just observe the whole thing differently. For me, anyway.
Oh, yeah, look, there's no right. There's, you know, so many individuals.
It's like one of those boom moments, yeah, of, wow, okay, this is not what I thought it was.
Is that one of the reasons you left then? Or is that the reason you left? Just because you felt totally disenfranchised, you'd removed away from it all?
I believe so, yeah. And also, you know, I was at that point then, I was posted in Abingdon, as I said earlier, it was close to where I grew up. And so what I found myself doing, the less engaged I felt over here, the more I was going home. So what I started to do was go home at weekends instead of staying in this environment.
Yeah.
So that, of course, wasn't helping. And then I lived in two realms. It was like I had the military here for 5 days and I was back home for 2-3 days. And the danger there was that the very things I was trying to escape from,
yeah,
I was walking back into, you know? So there was, again, it was drugs. It was all kinds of just the wrong. It was a mess for me, you know? It was a real mess. It's probably one of my lowest times in my whole life, I'd say. It was around about that time. And also, I felt shame of leaving, you know, that environment, and shame going back into this environment. It was a very mixed time for me. And it took a long time to really integrate, I'd say, almost both, because it was like a year notice over here and then integrating back in over here, you know.
And you didn't actually have a good shot at, you know, a good I've got a lot of positives and some negatives from my time in,
yeah,
and you never really got that shot, really, you know. You became disassociated from it straight away, and
yeah, but all the stuff I do have a positive for is all the stuff I love doing now, do you know what I mean? So there's don't get me wrong, I came away with some amazing stuff, of course. I think you always will,
yeah,
you know. I think just even just the people you meet and the mates you have, and for me, again, I guess it's that physicality has just become very, very strong. The discipline that comes with it enables me to do very much what I'm doing today, which a lot of people, they don't have. They don't have that, and they don't have that even connection to it. So I think that really helps me on a health level, I'd say, from a well-being perspective.
Looking back and taking the good stuff out of it.
Yeah,
because you already met. I mean, when you're speaking about your childhood, I could hear, you know, the things you're taking from it now, and how you're using that now.
Yeah.
How did you transition then? So you still really weren't properly worked because you joined at 17 and a half. You're now in your early 20s.
Yeah,
what
man.
What was that initial transition?
Still really young, right? Still really young. So my transition in was a year of just the same behaviour that I tried to escape from to get into the military. You know. And then I could just see it going really wrong for me. And but at the same time, I was into training. I loved training. I was a bit into bodybuilding in a way. I was like 13 half stone and trained hard, you know. And then a cousin of mine said, look, you know, have you thought about becoming a personal trainer? Because a personal trainer is great, you know. And they love a story. They love the fact you've been in the army. And in my head, it was like, I don't really feel like I've been in the army now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I said, right, okay, I'll give it a shot. I think, why not? You know, he's right, I look in great shape and I love training and I've been in the army. And anyway, so I decided, yeah, I thought I'd go and do a course. I did an intensive course, became a personal trainer, was lucky enough to slip right into a position that was in a town called Beaconsfield. Wasn't far, it was like 12 miles, I think, when we were living. So I'd cycle there, I'd coach there for the whole day. And suddenly everyone was like, oh my God, this guy's good, right? And I started to excel at it. And it was like that absorbent moment for me. It was almost everything. I just felt like I was born into this stuff. It was amazing. And I had such a sponge for it. And then the clients I'd see weren't driven by the things that I was looking for when I first went into personal training, this bodybuilding culture of developing muscle for muscle's sake. This was more about movement and understanding how to get stronger, more mobile, and they were a certain age. They were 40 plus. They weren't interested in the same things I was interested in. And all of a sudden, it made me adapt, and I had to look at it. We didn't have any resistance machines, any weights. It was purely nearly all body weight and benches and stuff like that. And the woman who ran it was quite unique in a sense. She was working with a couple of Premiership footballers, and she said, look, have you thought about this? Let's look at this. So I started to look at Pilates. And I went from that place to a Pilates studio.
In 97? Was that common back then?
No, we were like pioneering, really.
Really?
We were like some of the first Pilates studios coming out. And I looked at mat work, and I went from mat work in Pilates to equipment-based and equipment-based Pilates, as I thought was an opportunity to rehab, because if you understand the nature of it, it was originally Joseph Pilates' work. So to avoid joining the German police force, he fled Germany and ended up on a ship going to, I guess, Ellis Island at that point, off to New York, and met his wife, Clara, who was a nurse. So it gave him some credibility in his system that he developed. But he set up his first space above the New York City Ballet. So most of the movements you'd see were like to rehab dancers. So we found a way of basically we could rehab people with the equipment into better movers, basically, let's say. So it wasn't so dance orientated. It was a different system, but you could rehabilitate people. So we did that for a period of time. I again excelled it. And then someone said, look, I have a property. Do you want to take it on? And it was with osteos, physiotherapists, acupuncturists. And so again, my mind was like a sponge at this point, just wanting to absorb more and more. And I was like, yeah, do you know what? I can do this. So I then set up a practice on my own, built a big business. I was married at that time to my first wife, Katie. And then we bought a house, and the house we moved into was, it needed renovating anyway. So I took it on. I was renovating this place and coaching over this space. But we moved closer to her kind of tribe of influence, if you like. And that tribe of influence was her old friends, a bit like me being in the army and going back to my old friends. And it just meant a different culture again. So it meant the drink was coming in, the drugs were coming in.
Okay. So not a positive.
And it turned into a really negative marriage. It was like a real smash. So, and again, it was... Why is this keep happening? Why am I being shown the same thing? Why am I identifying this suffering? And so we split up anyway. And then I found myself I took on a big Pilates practice, moved location, set up a bigger Pilates practice, sold our flat. And within a year or two years, I met my second wife, which is Katerina. And that's kind of where a big shift for me occurred. It was like a very different person, a different environment for me to grow, very nurturing again.
A worldview of difference.
Just very different. And she was like very yoga orientated, quite spiritual, just a conscious being, studied psychology, psychotherapy, is from Slovakia, but came here and to convert a degree and was a nanny and held down a reception job and was converting her degree. So I had pure admiration for her, right? And she managed to just we've never had an argument, put it that way.
Right?
I mean, seriously. And for those that know me, like years ago.
Would
like,
she say that though?
No, she'd say that. She's like amazing, like really incredible. Yeah. She can just knows how to just tune me down a bit, you know?
Brilliant.
And when we had our first daughter, Lola, that was the real point for me to understand what was all the suffering and where did it come from. And I tuned into like the first 7 years of my life, and then I realized that those moments of punctuated nature in amongst it, what was happening in those environments was suffering. So the first 1,000 days of your life is the emotional layer of your brain, and then you have an imagination brain up until the age of 7, and then your intellect, boom, in that period. Mm. So all the tapes and recordings you've made within those first 7 years kind of become the templates for the rest of your life, your behaviours. This is Bruce Lipton's work, right? And so what you've been exposed to in those 7 years are the tapes you play out for the rest of your life. That's kind of the exposure to it. And I never understood that, but I could see that there was a rhythm to what I was doing and what I was experiencing. But in amongst that, I also could identify what made me feel amazing and what was the happiness. And in my dark times over here, how could I gain that? And then you identify that through different processes, different courses and different spaces I've been into and that have enabled me through the coaching experience I have, is that really when we have human suffering, it's when our physical, social and spiritual needs aren't met. So over here, being in a concrete box, not seeing much of my dad, staring in front of a TV, isn't nourishing. Mm. On a physical, social and spiritual sense, it's not, but we've normalized it. So it's socially normal, but we don't identify that that's not biologically normal.
Yeah.
it's biologically extreme because underneath it, underneath all the DNA and everything, strip it right back for 200,000 years, we're incredible beings running around the most hostile environment. So I'm a bit of a geek when it comes to YouTube parkour experts and free runners and stuff like that. So I love all that stuff. And it's kind of in me. I know, I just want to do that, you know? But that would have been kind of the norm at some stage, you know what I mean?
Mm.
Just not buildings, just arboreal movement in trees and land and just incredible stuff.
And the best
stuff.
People like doing that kind of stuff are the ones that are surviving and
yeah,
thriving.
Yeah, exactly, and they're thriving. So what is it? How is it they're thriving? And then I started to, in my coaching time, I was lucky enough to work with a guy called Nicholas Romanoff. And
time is this then in years?
So this was when Lola, so 9 years ago Lola was born, so right. 9 years ago from now, 2009.
Yeah.
And we met this guy called Nicholas Romanoff, and Romanoff was a track and field coach in the Soviet era. So back then, those guys were like film stars, absolute geniuses, what they were doing. He discovered something called the pose, and it was a specific posture that everyone has to go to when they run. And the more efficient runners just go from that posture to the next posture. So it's like they land in the same posture and then go off again.
Right.
And what he identified is the common theme. So there's a stat that 80% of runners give up through injury. Why is that? If we were running species for 200,000 years, these amazing hunter-gatherer sapiens that were persistent hunters, how is it that today 80% of runners are giving up through injury? And so he started to look at footwear being rubberized, so it would delay impact forces or dumb down impact or your mind's perception of impact forces. You can't take the impact forces away, but you can dumb down the feedback. And also the posture, and it was the posture he identified. So his pose method is basically a posture method. It's a specific posture everyone has to go to. And then we started to see it, and we go, okay, what he's basically saying is that hunter-gatherers have this posture. That's what they run like. And we're almost zoo humans trying to perform a running action of a wild animal.
Mm.
So what is it? What's different? And it was called jogging, and jogging was like a modern phenomenon. Jogging's like a hybrid version between walking and running. It doesn't exist in nature. They just walk, run, sprint. And we walk, we jog, we run, we sprint. And so jogging was what 80% of these runners are going out and doing because their cushioning was allowing them to land on areas of the feet they're not designed to load.
You mean like trainers? Cushion trainers?
Just cushion trainers. Anything above 3 millimeters means that it dumbs down your mind's perception of impact forces. It doesn't mean they're not there. It just tells your brain that it's okay to load your heel. And normally that heel's only there for walking. You have like 3 rocking actions in your ankle. Yes, you have a heel rocker, an ankle rocker, and a 4-foot rocker. So it goes heel first, then the ankle, and then you roll off your big toe.
Mm.
That's for walking. When you run, you're meant to land on the ankle and go off on the 4-foot. And when you sprint, you have the 4-foot. So it's very intelligent design. So it's all around forces. What are the forces, impact forces that are involved walking, running, sprinting? In walking, there's 1 times your body weight. In running, there's 2 times your body weight. And in sprinting, there's 3 times your body weight. So we start to see, there's a specific shape that I have to make due to those forces. Each one of them is different.
Mm.
Like a horse will walk, canter, gallop, yeah?
Mm.
Walk, trot, canter, gallop, right? Whereas a human should be walking, running, and walking, trotting, and running, sprinting, but not jogging, right? And so I started to look at that, and we were working with a company called Wild Fitness, and their motto was to take wild zoo humans and turn them into wild humans. And so that helped us identify that there's a process here. That makes perfect sense. And then we met this guy called Erwan Nakor, set up a system called MoveNat. And MoveNat was based on George Hubert's work. And George Hubert was like a French Marine officer that went out to all these indigenous populations in the late 1800s and looked at these amazing specimens and said, wow, look at those guys. Look at my Marines. You know, it's kind of, what is it they're doing? How are they in such fantastic shape? And he mapped out there were 10 fundamental movements that we should all be able to carry out. You know, walking, running, jumping, lifting, carrying, throwing, balancing, throwing, defending. And he's the brain behind the original assault course. So the military assault course today is shaped off George Hebert's work. So then I was like, wow, okay, if that's the case, then there's got to be a pose method for each one of those. There's got to be a natural way of doing them. Because if running is a natural way and we've got a zoo human way, which is jogging, what is the way of accessing the way we should balance? And then you start to unravel it and you see that there's specific postures and things that we are dumbing down in a way through becoming a sitting culture and wearing certain clothing and footwear. So then I looked at that. That was like a movement system. And then it became to this point where, well, what are the rest of the physical aspects? So if movement's one, what are all our physical needs? So then our physical needs are sleep, movement, food, play, water, rest. and you start to look in sunlight, and you start to look at all that and air quality, and you start to look at that and you say, right, okay, there's biological normal ways of carrying these out, or there's biologically extreme ways, right? But what's normalized today is more biologically extreme. So the air quality, let's say the air quality in this room, right? They say the pollutants inside a building are 2.5 times more potent than outside. And we have loads of measures, don't we, for the outside, but we don't really consider the inside. So simple things that I could then say to people, right, okay, the biologically normal way of just flipping it, the environment, you can't strip this away. We have to be in this room right now. We're recording something and hopefully someone might learn from it. Mm. So how do we make this more of a growth promoting space than a compromising space? So, okay, so I look at it and I go, right, there's a biologically extreme, here's a biological normal. What's the biological normal? Okay, plants, they have air purification abilities, right? You can buy an air purification system that sits in the corner and removes 99.9% of pollutants in the room. Why is it important? Because Alzheimer's, dementia, all these things that are driven by neurotoxins are in the very things that we're breathing in. So through benzene, xylene in the paints, through mastics, through carpets, formaldehyde, all those things are contained within a building we're breathing in. So that was air quality. Okay, then let's have a look at sleep. Okay, sleep's amazing, right? So again, there's biologically normal ways of sleeping and there's biologically extreme. And I'm writing a whole chapter around sleep at the moment, but it's not a chapter on sleep. It's a chapter on melatonin, because everyone's banging on about sleep. All the new books that are being published, we've gone from diet almost through to sleep, is that we have to achieve a certain amount of growth promoting hours asleep, right? We have to be asleep for this. And if we don't, then we can suffer from those mental health issues for a start, because insomnia is just going to drive you insane, right? And it's not growth promoting that way. So we will suffer physically, socially, spiritually if we don't get our sleep right. Okay, so.
So give you a chance to have a drink as well.
I know, I'm just off on one. I'm glad you reeled me in, mate. Yes.
Because you said it loads before you started going, 5 minutes ago, you said humans suffering about five
yes.
times.
Yeah.
And all these things now we're discussing
yeah.
are to prevent or to. Yeah. Prevent human suffering.
Exactly.
And then we look at sleep. And so we've spoke a lot about on this podcast about PTSD, about yeah. poor mental health, as well yeah, as yeah. good mental health and resilience and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But something, even in the conversations I'm having away from the podcast, go back to sleep
yeah, man.
And how people are suffering with sleep, especially with the people suffering from PTSD where they're struggling with sleep.
Mm.
So this stuff now, I'm thinking like, well, even if a takeaway of what you're about to say, can help someone sleep and rest.
Oh yeah, man. There's value in that, right?
Yeah, please, let's go.
Okay, so the sleep study suggests that, so if you look at it this way, the biologically normal way and a biologically extreme way. So the biologically normal way would be, can I strip it back and talk about some one thing to introduce
yeah,
this?
Question, yeah.
So there was a study called the Rat Park Study. So the Rat Park Study was by Bruce Alexander, and I think it was in 1976, the study, but it was published in 1981. And it was based on rats in a laboratory in a cage. And the rats in the laboratory in the cage were given a water feeder and a water feeder with opiates in it. And the rats in the cage would ignore the water and they keep going to the opiates. And they keep going and keep going and keep going until they show signs of addiction and then they die, right? So then Bruce Alexander looks at it and he says, well, this is great. It's a drug classification, basically. He looks at it and he goes, this is great, but rats don't live in cages, right? They don't live in laboratories. So let's get the rats and let's create a rat park. And the rats can do everything they want, right? They can run around, they can sleep how they want, they get the right appropriate lighting, they get to eat what a rat wants to eat, they get to have sex, they get to do all the amazing things a rat could possibly want to do. And let's have a look how addicted they are. So then he puts the same number of rats and the same water feeder and the same drug feeder, the opiate feeder, in the rat park. And not one rat shows sign of addiction, not one rat dies. They only go to the water feeder and they very occasionally self-medicate. Like all animals will self-medicate on plants or whatever they do. They intuitively know how to do it. We kind of lost that through our evolution, but they have that still, right? So then you think, oh, okay, maybe it's just, you know, it's just the rats. What about the addicts over here? So then he takes the addicted rats and he puts them in the rat park that he's created where they can get all their needs met, physically, socially, spiritually. The rats get their needs met over here. So he removes them from suffering into where they can get their needs met. And they go through self-withdrawal. So the rats don't carry on supplementing the opiates. They go through self-withdrawal, right? And they heal. So that's and we're not rats, I know, but it's an example of if this animal is suffering, it will choose ways to...
Alleviate the suffering.
Alleviate the suffering, which is called pacification. So they pacify. So that's where drugs come in, drinks come in,
yeah.
Shopping comes in, dopamine, gram, yeah. Instagramming, swiping, typing, whatever it is, sex, whatever it is, masturbation, all those things are pacifying what would be the suffering, right? And so that's kind of where I went with it, into, right, okay, how do we create a human park? So then we can look at sleep, right? So sleep in the human park, not the laboratory. In the laboratory, it's around, they have electromagnetic chaos going on, wires everywhere, you're rigged up to things to test on how much sleep you need. And in there, it's if you don't get 7 to 9 hours sleep, then you can create what they call a sleep debt. And a sleep debt, you can't get it back. It's like if you missed 8 hours sleep today, yeah, you can go and try and top up 9 hours here. It's too late. You've lost it, right? So that's okay. The best thing is just ignore that. What are the things I can do to enable me? So even if I can't get to sleep, what are the things I can do to enable the environment to still be nurturing for me? That's the way I look at it. Because I deal with all kinds of clients. You know, they're from all walks of life. And some of the entrepreneurs I'm dealing with, they can't be asleep. It's impossible. They've got like several businesses on the go. And some of them might be in the States and have to take calls at weird hours, right? So then what I found was a wave of people coming in. Oh, my God, I didn't get my 8 hours sleep, man. I'm so stressed. I've got this going on. I was like, whoa, hold on a minute. In the laboratory, 8 hours sleep, yeah, of course. But let's have a look how sleep is in nature. What happens in nature? Okay, so we can start to look at tribes, right? There's three tribes from three separate different geographic locations. And they look at them over a period of 100 days. And not one of those members of the tribe are asleep for 8 hours. That's the starting point of it, right? Not even 7 hours, right? They get between 5.1 and 6.5 hours, right? But they're also up and down throughout the night. So they're asleep, in the depth of sleep, probably about 10 p.m., and then they start to pick up again. So when you have sleep-wake cycles, they're actually identifying and showing us a proper sleep-wake. They're awake, and they get up, and they tend to the fire because they can't afford for a fire to go out. They have to have a fire to work with in the morning. They look after the young, and they fix their tools. And some are even known to be up walking around smoking, right? So some tribes are even partying through the night. You know, it's just a very different way of doing it. But the theme is that over 100 days, how many hours do you think 100 members of the tribe would have been asleep together?
All together, at the same time.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to say none.
18 minutes, right?
Oh, 18.
Only 18 minutes are they all asleep. So it just goes to show that there's no one there killing it with sleep, right?
Yeah.
But if we're led to believe that it will lead you to be chronically stressed, you end up with this symptom, which would be diabetes or obesity. The reason obesity, because ghrelin, your hormone that tells you, right, I'm hungry, basically. It's suppressed by melatonin. So melatonin will suppress ghrelin. It's not sleep, it's melatonin.
What's melatonin?
So melatonin is a hormone, again, that we, through serotonin, one of your happy hormones, and an amino acid called tryptophan, is synthesized in your body. And it's not just a sleep hormone, it has several different functions. So there's sites in the pancreas, melatonin sites in the pancreas, that stop insulin resistance, right? So with diabetes, with melatonin. It suppresses ghrelin, but it also picks up leptin. Leptin's like the satiating hormone that tells you, oh, I've had enough food right now, right?
So it's a good thing.
Oh, so melatonin's amazing, right? It has so many amazing functions. It stops the proliferation of cancer, and the reason that is one of its main roles is apoptosis, which is how you transform unhealthy cells into healthy cells. So melatonin is like the key to this whole discussion on sleep. So for me, it's not really about sleep. It's about melatonin. How do we get appropriate levels of melatonin? And what they've discovered in what's different between the natural sleep habitat and the zoo cage laboratory example of the human park study, let's say. Yeah. So over here, we're surrounded by lighting. Okay. So lighting tricks us into thinking it's daylight when it should be nighttime. That's one thing, right? And so, as I say, they're awake through the night. What they don't have is the ability to turn on a light switch to illuminate their cave or their around the fire, right? They just have firelight. And firelight is very different. So the fire emits an amber tone, an amber light, whereas the light bulb has blue and green spectrums in it. And it's the blue spectrums that, when you look at that light, it signals the pineal gland suprachiasmatic nucleus to switch off or suppress melatonin. So you can no longer have melatonin in your system. Like now, we don't have melatonin because it's daylight. So at, say, between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m., melatonin levels should start to come up. and by 10 p.m. they should be at their peak. And then their main role between 10 p.m. and say 2 a.m. that's the real depth of it, is real anabolic sleep, and that's where we can human growth hormone is secreted. But you need melatonin for that as well. So all the cellular stuff, amazing stuff, happens between those hours, and anything after that is said to be a kind of a bonus in a way, right? And then when it gets to the morning, you wake up at 6 a.m., let's say, driven by our circadian rhythm, our lighting ambient cycles, melatonin should start to creep out and other hormones, daylight hormones, start to come in.
Right. Okay.
So in the day, we get rid of melatonin. We wouldn't be able to function.
So it's a rest hormone.
It's a rest and sleeping hormone, it enables health and growth.
Right.
So it enables the cells, basically, us to go through this process of transforming our unhealthy cells into healthy cells, right?
Yeah.
So amazing, 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 right? So then we go from there to... its role. So what's the difference is, we in the daylight, we shouldn't have melatonin in our system. And it gets to the nighttime, you need this maximum melatonin to go through all its processes, right? Mm. Our healing, growth-promoting state. But when you get to that 6 p.m. state and you arrive home, around 7, 8 o'clock, we go ding and we put the lights on, we still don't have melatonin when it should be peaking, because melatonin is suppressed by the blue and green spectrums of light.
Right.
And the studies show that anything above 60 lux will suppress melatonin. The average light bulb, let's say, is between 600 and 2,000 lux. So it doesn't really stand a chance. We go, yeah, but hold on, the moon and the star, what about those? Well, the moon and the stars are only 1 lux of light. Put it into that. You know, it's incredible.
A campfire.
Again, it's amber tones. It doesn't matter.
Right, okay.
And because there's no blue spectrum in there. So it's only the blue and green spectrums that enable this light to be so bright. But the bonuses are, what I've got all my clients doing is they can just put a pair of glasses on in the evening that have an amber tint to them.
Mm.
They're specifically for removing blue light.
I have a pair of these. In the evening, if I'm on the computer,
boom,
I put it on.
And they're called blue blockers, right? Yeah. So that blue blocking action will enable you to still go off the growth promoting states, but not be asleep. So it's not saying you have to be asleep for 8 hours, but you do have to recreate what Bruce Alexander did with the rat park. He went from this to creating a rat park for the rats to run around in, a sleep habitat for them to get their food appropriate, everything else. We need to try and find ways of creating a human park. So your sleep habitat is that. So I'd look at the air quality in your bedroom is one, you know, put air purification systems in place, biophilic design, bring plants in.
Mm.
You're going to be basically breathing in and out the same air for 8 hours. You don't really want it to be a toxic, loading, neurotoxic environment. You want it to be clean it up, right? So you could be looking at that. You can then change the lighting. So you can now buy Hue lighting is one. Bulbs that you can put in.
How do you spell that?
Hue, as in the Hue, kind of the hues of light. So that's a Philips Hue bulb. There's another one by Aura Glow, A-U-R-A Glow, and they're simple ones. They're spotlights or screw-in bulbs or bayonets, and they have a remote control, and you just go dink, and then it switches to amber. So in the evening, you've washed your room with amber. There's no blue tones in there. So then it becomes growth-promoting. And you watch. I've had clients that they're the ones that come and say, I never sleep. I never sleep. I've got insomnia. I've had this. And within 3 days, they're, wow, my sleep's improved.
Are they doing things like removing screen time then and TV time?
You don't need to, because you're wearing amber glasses.
So if you, let's say from 7 o'clock, if you have a nighttime
routine.
Yeah,
man, just put your amber glasses on. Yeah.
They look cool. I look cool in mine.
Yeah, some of them are a bit, you know, yeah, you wouldn't want to go out. But I've discovered quite a few pairs. So there's one by Felix Gray, and Felix Gray glasses. I went out to dinner the other evening with them on, and not one person said a word. They just thought I wore glasses, right?
Yeah.
So no one said it, and I'm sitting there going, this is great.
Were you in London, though?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there you go. Then you could put anything on.
But they're just like normal, you know what I mean? They're just like normal reading glasses. Yeah. Whereas others, there's another brand called Swannies that I think I get away with in the home. I'm not too sure I get away with wearing them.
I put them on, yeah.
So they're quite cool. Katerina seems to like those ones as well, so that's nice. Yeah, so that's what you would call it today, I think, is called biohacking. That's a way of doing it.
A practical tip.
Lighting is key to sleep. Nutrition is key to sleep as well. So cut the caffeine back after it gets to, some say 4, I'd strip it right back. I'd say anything past noon, just get the caffeine out.
Oh, really?
If you're going to have a coffee, just get it in the morning to maybe help you. But what you'll find is if you get your sleep in check, you'll wake up like on it. And we should all be waking up on it, because if we didn't, again, through evolution, if we're all going, I hit in the snooze button,
Yeah.
We wouldn't be here today having this conversation.
No, we'd be dead, yeah.
You know what I mean? So yeah. All your hormones and everything has to be in check for us to be on it and moving. So if you're waking up groggy in the morning, look at your sleep hygiene. Look at what you're doing to get you into a sleep state, you know? So if you're smashing 8 hours sleep, brilliant, great. Stick to what you're doing. If you're in a really dark room, great again. But if you get up from your dark room, you go to the toilet and switch a light bulb on.
Okay.
It's just, it takes a second.
What did you just say then? Your sleep hygiene?
I called it sleep hygiene, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just so everything, it's not just in the bed.
So basically, you look at your whole sleep habitat, everything within that environment, which is your home. That's the stuff you have responsibility for. That's your home. How do you make your home a growth-promoting human park or a human laboratory?
So even if you've got young children like me and lots of other people out there and yourself.
I've got three kids.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got young children that still, I'm knackered. I've got kids. You know, they was up. They had the cough and the cold and all that. Actually, if you just do what you just said then and start.
Change your relationship with it.
Yeah. And actually accepting that.
Yeah. We have a 9-year-old, a 7-year-old and a 2-year-old, right? Mm. And Tallulah, you know what it's like. They could be up, right? I'm not sleeping tonight. I'm doing this instead. I want to do this. Yeah. And, you know, and you're like, oh, great. That's great. But I've got to get up. I'm getting up at 5 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah.
I don't have that conversation anymore. I just, my glasses stay on. And I just, okay, whatever. If he wants to get up, okay, let's go and do something else. And we go into another room, but we've got amber lighting. It doesn't matter. No one's melatonin is being suppressed. All our hormones and our metabolism is still just how it should be, how it would be in nature. Because how are those hunter-gatherers, again, getting up and doing what they're doing, and being able to look after the young, look after the fire, and fix their tools and weapons, right? Do you understand? Our whole conversation is driven in the laboratory. We don't really look into nature to discuss what is it over there that's, how are they doing it? How are they benefiting? How do they look so amazing? How do they move so well, right? Mm. You know?
I want to hit some points with you as well, which I think will benefit.
Yeah, go for it, man. Of course.
I could just set you off and you'd be gone, giving value all day. And it's good, mate. The least in these things, when I speak minimal, it's always good. Everyone wants to hear my voice. But move it, because I was speaking to you before. I've just done an ultra marathon. I've done very little prep for it, but I wanted to make sure, if I could manage myself around with nutrition and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's in Breck and it's beautiful. I was happy all the way around. I didn't really get into a negative mindset. But one thing, I had real tight hips. I went into from kind of viewing you from afar, I went into this real deep squat halfway around, totally sorted me out. Like, it was like a miracle.
Yeah.
And I wanted to kind of talk about nature. I want you to talk about nature, the relationship between nature and movement and physical activity and the benefits that can kind of bring.
Yeah, well, there's huge studies around, well, I call it elemental nutrition or nature gains. You know, we talk about gains today, but I have nature gains for people. So the study is that 83% of the UK live in urban environments, and they spend 90% of their time, we spend 90% of our time indoors. That's the average urbanite. So even my man-bunned hippie mates who run around half naked on Hampstead Heath climbing trees, that's still tough to get their 10%.
Right.
You know, so I ask people to set a timer on their phone. It's very simple. You set a timer for 2 hours 24, which is 10% of 24 hours. And you have to try and get 10% outdoors per day, right? And a lot of people are coming back, oh my God, this is tough, man. How do we find that? So you realize all of a sudden that we spend more than 90% of our time is indoors. Most people, it's much more. We're probably gaining more at a weekend. Saturdays and Sundays, good opportunity to get out. Mm. So it's about getting out in nature for 10%, but also, as I was talking earlier, it's really, if 90% of the time is spent indoors, we also need to look at those areas. How do you make them growth promoting? So as we were explaining earlier, so bring more nature in, that's a clue, right? Just bring more plants in, clean up the air, look at lighting, that's great. So that's that habitat. So why is it so important to be outside? So again, it just goes into the same philosophy is what Bruce Alexander's proving, right? So we're not designed to live indoors. We're not designed to be in amongst artificial light, EMG, electromagnetic chaos. We're meant to be this wild animal that runs around, right? It's evolution, right? So we think that we've evolved, let's say, to the environments we're in today because we just normalized it. But there's lots of studies around nature's deficit disorder, and how growth promoting is forest bathing, I think they call it, where you just basically go, take people out into the woods and they sit under a tree and they meditate, or they just, and they're dealing with depression.
There's serious links between like reducing depression, anxiety, and things like PTSD by looking at a mountain.
Yeah, man.
By looking at the sway of a tree or the movement of birds.
Even images. So there's a study that shows that even a book, someone that has, so the sympathetic nervous system is fight and flight response, right? So in a fight and flight response, and then the parasympathetic is rest and digest. So they measure people, they show they're in a sympathetic state, which most of us are in fight and flight response. How do they get them to go into parasympathetic state? And they show them images of a book, and they show urban settings, and then they show them nature scenes. And nature scenes, they immediately drop into parasympathetic state. That's how potent nature is, just to be even staring at images. So again, in your home, you can put images of nature up. Of course you can, instead of, you know, so it's just simple stuff. But getting out, going out, and I think that's, for me, going right back into the army. And when I was a kid, those moments I was saying about punctuated in amongst my concrete existence was to be out in the trees, climbing, being in nature. You don't have to be a crazy man bun hippie running around half naked on the heath. You can just be, okay, do you know what? I'm going to go to the park for lunch, just get a bit of green. You can get a bit of grounding going, they say. You can just simply just kick off your shoes and get to experience the ground underneath your feet, right? Ah, there's a tree. Let me go and sit underneath the tree and read a book, right? Sun gazing, staring at the sun in the first part of the day, the last part of the day, the first 45 minutes and the last 45 minutes, incredibly growth promoting again. In terms of depression, again, I'd say, yeah, definitely. I hold retreats and we just fully immerse people in. Some of them, they might have to go and build shelter and live in a shelter overnight. We have like a special forces guy that comes in, teach them how to sight, how to build a shelter with whatever's available at that moment. And again, just the nurturing of that and how deep it is.
But you look at the military community. And you've already said you get these guys in as experts to show people.
Yeah.
People will be listening to this going, well, that's what I used to do, but I don't do it anymore.
Actually, yeah, man.
The benefits of it are free. Like, you can go out and do stuff for free.
Because we just don't, we just disconnect from nature. That's the first thing that goes. But really, if you look into all the growth-promoting sides of it, where do you feel your best, you know? Just simply, you can even be outside this building right now looking up at the sky. It's still nature. You get blue sky. That's the point. And that will then help your evening hormones. You know what I mean? So there's a whole balance between it. So there's growth promoting, as in the ambient cycles. Get under the blue sky. That will help boost your serotonin, which will then help you synthesize melatonin for the evening. So if you're having trouble sleeping, get up in the morning. Set an alarm. Make sure you get up every single day the same time. Keep it regular. And get outside. You know, get outside as quickly as you can, because it's that blue sky, which we're talking about lux of light. The average light bulb is between 600 and 2,000. The sky is like 200,000, you know? Mm. And it's that, boom, that then gets all your hormones in check and regulates you, and then you're away for the day. So that's how you get to balance all your hormones that way. So I would, yeah, I'd certainly be looking at get out to a green space. If you can't get to a green space, get under the blue sky. Try and accumulate, set a timer. Go for the game that I've been setting people. I call it the Urbanite Challenge, is to just get 10% of your day outside.
Two hours, 20 minutes.
And again, it can be, you know, you can join Clark. There's people doing exercise. I mean, what about, what was it called? British Military Fitness.
Yeah.
Again, outdoor classes, right? They were huge, those classes. In Hampstead Heath, they just took over, right? Mm. But there's other people setting other things up. It doesn't have to be British Military Fitness. There's other stuff. There's a guy that teaches like arboreal movement, where you go climbing in the trees and you learn to balance in trees and run around the trees.
You know, one thing, and you haven't really gone into it too much, but one thing is rowing a rowing machine or deadlifting in a gym.
Mm.
Actually, what you're saying, what I'm getting from you is just get outside and do something.
I wouldn't go near this, but don't go near the gym, because again, the gym is just another indoor environment.
Yeah.
That you're in the same poor air quality, poor lighting, and all the things that probably are just help feeding the suffering. Go out into the growth promoting spaces like nature.
So for me, my garden, if I want 20 minutes, get the rowing machine in the garden, pull on the rowing machine in the garden.
Yeah, but again, rowing's, I would go even deeper. I'd say rowing is an unnatural pattern. It's not natural to row, because you're sitting and you're pulling, right?
Got you.
I'd even get a rope. Skipping's more natural because it involves jumping, right? Yeah. And it's about elasticity and timing, and it helps posture, and it will improve your running. You know?
Press ups,
movement. Body weight. Work with your own body. Work with your own body weight. Put a pull-up bar up or something, you know?
Okay.
But try and just get, even if it's, again, even if it's in the garden, but just get outside rather than doing everything we do inside, because again, it just feeds that same level of suffering, really.
One thing I want to talk to you about just before we kind of wrap up, really, something that I got into a couple of years ago because of an injury, and that was the benefits of cold water.
Oh, yeah.
And I became addicted to it.
Yeah.
You know, 4 minutes in as cold a shower as I could get.
Nice.
I was already outdoor swimming anyway. I was doing triathlon and all that kind of stuff. But
yeah,
just submerging in cold water, not being even active in it, just the benefits of just lying in a lake or getting in the cold shower, even before bed, I just thought it helped me sleep better.
Mm.
I know you've gone right into it.
Yeah, I think it's... Well, it's like natural movement, you know, as I say, that we have to look at our evolution again and where we've come from, I guess. So like the crazy kids jumping off of buildings, the parkour guys and the free runners, that's what we'd have all been doing. So I guess that's the deeper connection to it, of natural movement. And then, so we're like X-Men in a way. We have this ability to move all through different terrains, and we've moved through all different hostile environments, right? And so... Wim Hof is the guy, really. You know, he's just, again, smashed it for me. Like, I go barefoot running, and I'm about to run from Land's End to John O'Groats barefoot, right? So that's like a marathon a day for 31 days. And people go, that's insane. How are you going to walk about your feet? And I'm like, yeah, but that would have been the norm, you know? If running barefoot is the norm, just we've dumbed down our feet, right? So Wim Hof's saying is that, you know, he's got 26 world records, man, where... He's immersed in ice, and what they show is where normally after a number of minutes the hypothermia would start to kick in. His temperature's going up.
Yeah,
you know. And then they say and then the bit that blew my mind was about the autonomous nervous system. So he said, look, you can inject me with a toxin. So he said, inject me with E. coli, right? And there's no change in his vitals, man. So for breath work and just, I mean, it's what we can control. So I think the thing I think works for me, and I hold workshops with that method with a guy called Arthur Paulins. He's like one of Wim Hof's disciples, really. And the thing that I think is more beneficial is to work on the breath, because the breath of that system enables you to go from, you know, I was talking about images, go from urban environments to nature scenes, and it takes you from a stressed fight and flight to a rest and digest, which is parasympathetic. You can do that with breathing. So if you find that you're, I've got to go into, say if I was really stressed about coming and doing this interview today, I'd just sit outside, I'd do 10 cycles of breath. I breathe in from my nose, deep inhalation into my belly, and then I breathe out as if I'm misting a mirror. And then I breathe in again, do 10 cycles like that. And that's enough to drop me from stress, fight and flight to parasympathetic rest and digest. So we have the power to literally change in a moment. So guys that I get to see with depression, all kinds of things, you can deal with it through breath work. They just have to be more consistent in it, you see. And so you can work with the cold. So Wim Hof's method is that I would do, I do 30 cycles of breath, like deep inhalation, and then an out breath. Which is more like a letting go. So you can even flip that.
It's not forceful, is it?
No, it's not forceful, because you want to, again, try and return into a relaxed state. And then I create a cycle. So rather than it be a big pickup and a drop off, it's like a cycle of breath. So we go. So you keep the cycle. You do 30 breaths. You get to number 30. It's a full cycle. So it will finish with an out breath. You breathe out softly, you then hold, and you hold that for as long as you possibly can. Not to the point where you're like, oh my God, but it should still remain relaxed. And then you take a breath in, and you hold that breath for 10 seconds, and then you do another cycle. So I do 30 cycles like that, holding breath. I do another 30, and then I finish on 40. So I call that my 100. I do a 100 cycles of breath, and then I get into a cold tub or an ice bath. And I do that pretty much every day. So I do a... This cold tap at the moment is pretty cold. But anyway, so the cold work is great. It will help boost the immune system. Again, cellular health's only going to improve from it. And it helps you understand that most people, if they approach cold, when you first get them in for a workshop, they're like, oh my God, it's the cold, it's this. You teach them how to deal with stress in that moment. That's what I'm saying. I think the breath is the most beneficial. So they look at the ice as a stressful situation, and they can manage their stress before going in the ice by going from a sympathetic state to a parasympathetic state by breathing. And it's the breathing that really is the take-home message from this. What I'm trying to say is that you have the power to transform yourself. You know, you can do it in sleep. Just sort your sleep environment out. You have the power to get out in nature. You have the power to work on breath. And more so from being a military personnel, you have the power because you're disciplined.
How can we follow you on social media?
I am known as, I am at The Natural Lifestylist. It always feels like a bit of a sale, this, doesn't it?
Yeah, no sell.
I'm at The Natural Lifestylist on Instagram, and then my website is just tonyriddle.com. So we actually have some stuff coming out. I think in the new year we've got one of those workshops coming on, which is movement, and so we call it Move, Breathe, Chill, as in getting the chiller. And just for me, it's just, again, it's the message of learning how to move appropriately, how nature intended, which will help you run better, will help you climb better, but help you be consistent with it. Because if you don't run or move how nature intended, you heighten the risk of an injury, which then throws you out of all the stuff that's growth promoting and makes you feel amazing, gets all the amazing hormones going. And then, again, the breath work will put the power in your hands. You can literally, and if you need to pick yourself up, you breathe in a different way. If you need to slow yourself down, you breathe in other ways. So after the guy who will be on the workshop, he's a genius at this stuff. He knows so many different breathing patterns. And that's what you don't realize. There's all these different states of breath that we can enter. We literally just switch your mood around. So if you need picking up in the afternoon, rather than smashing coffee, you just do deep inhalations through your mouth and out through your mouth. If you want to rest and chill yourself out, you take deep inhalations through your nose and out through your mouth. So before, if you're lying in bed in the evening and you've got shit going on, oh my God, and you've got all stuff going on, you're being torn in different directions or going into trauma in your sleep, use the breath, man. Go into breathe in through the nose, out through the mouth. Rest a book on your stomach, so you should be able to feel the book rising. And then just soft and just keep returning it back to the breath. Whenever you're stressed, go back to the breath. And if it doesn't work, breathe more. You know, people count your sheep, go count your breath. Yeah.
Awesome.
Thanks, man.
We'll leave it there.
Cool.